If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the 1-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Has the Omicron variant peaked? Just as President Biden's free test website launches, plus President Trump jostles a little bit with Governor Ron DeSantis about booster shots. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, columnist Kim Strassel and editorial writer Jason Willick. After a big surge in COVID-19 cases after Christmas, the moving average at the Centers for Disease Control is now trending down again, and the size of this spike on the chart shows why news organizations and others have started de-emphasizing these case counts. At its peak, the moving average was close to 790,000 new cases a day, and of course, that's not counting a lot of people who had mild symptoms and did a home test that was positive that wasn't reported. But just for comparison, the previous high last January was about 225,000 a day, and of course, the daily death count is almost 50% lower than it was last January. So it shows, Kim, I think that Omicron is a different animal. There are lots of people vaccinated now. There are new treatments. The trends are going in the right direction. And so is it too optimistic to hope that this is the last COVID wave?
Not at all, especially because we're also, and I think this is important, seeing this phenomenon in other countries as well, too. In particular, the place where Omicron first seemed to have reared its head, which was South Africa, and it saw a very dramatic rise, but also a very rapid fall. Now, obviously, we're talking about aggregate case numbers across the country. What we're seeing in reality is that some areas it has peaked and is already falling. In some places like the Northeast, there are some areas that are still heading slightly up that curve or reaching a plateau. It's going to be another good few weeks here before we begin to see case counts coming down everywhere. But overall, it does seem to be really good news, especially because if what we're listening to from doctors is that this is obviously a milder version, fewer hospitalizations, it has affected a lot more people and therefore provided whether a natural immunity, sometimes along with a vaccinated immunity, that's leading to a kind of hybrid immunity, which means we should be very well positioned as well for the next variant that comes along.
Kim, that's a fair point that there's a lot of regionality here. And what I was going to say next was to emphasize that a lot of these Biden actions look like they are coming too late. And I think that's true for my region of the country in the Northeast. Maybe it's not true for elsewhere. But this week, there was the launch of covidtests.gov, a website. And I've got to say that it has exceeded expectations so far. When you think about the government racing to set up a healthcare website, I think, where have I heard that before? What could possibly go wrong? But I did some participatory journalism and logged on to covidtest.gov, and I've got to say it was pretty clean. It was pretty fast. There's one button that takes you to a USPS website, a postal service website. You put your name in, you put your address in, the total says $0. You check out and you get a confirmation email. Now the next question is how fast this stuff is going to get out to people. My confirmation email says that once the package ships, I will get a tracking number and that the tests are expected to ship starting in late January. But Jason, that means that people may not be getting them until early February. And I wonder what the Omicron case counts are going to look like when they show up at my door.
Sure. Hopefully lower. You know, I'm not as confident about predicting the end of COVID just because we've had four waves. And I think, you know, the first one, the second, the sort of initial spike in the winter and starting in New York City, that tapered away. Then we had another one over the summer. Then we had the Delta, which kicked in just as people were getting vaccinated and seemed to, which we thought was the end of the vaccine. And then once Delta was over, we thought we were done. Now we have Omicron. I think there will be more variants, as Kim says, but what we're hoping is that they're going to be milder still than Omicron. So, Kyle, you may want to, since you've ordered your tests, you may want to keep a hold of them anyway for the next letter in the Greek alphabet when that comes along. Although, then again, hopefully it's so mild that just like the other coronaviruses in circulation that you don't even bother to get tested. You just stay home if you're not feeling well.
The other recent move by the Biden administration that I think is worth talking about is its mandate on insurance companies to cover the cost of at-home rapid COVID-19 tests. There was a regulation that was put out on January 10th. It requires insurance companies and group health plans to cover the cost of at-home COVID-19 tests. It was effective January 15th, so not a lot of time. And Kim, there's been some interesting news coverage about the fact that insurers don't have systems for this. They don't have billing codes for this. They're not in the business, typically, of processing photos of CVS receipts that people take on their phones and email in. And here's an interesting quote from a insurance broker in Texas. She says, there will be some people who buy them and then have a six-month nightmare trying to get reimbursed, unquote.
Yeah, a good example of how no matter what government may think, it can't just wave a magic wand and in 5 days expect entire systems to try to catch up with it or implement rules like this. So, you know, in theory, how this is supposed to work is it's supposed to allow millions of consumers to just go pick up their tests at thousands of locations and not spend a dime. But as you mentioned, the insurers, they currently have a very complex billing system that relies on all these codes for insurers to process claims. And these are the kind of codes that are used between hospitals and insurers and doctors and insurers. They're not set up in any way to deal with retail receipts. And so it's going to take some time to get that system up and going. And that time, by the way, is not now when people need it most. So this goes back again, I think, to the Biden administration, how flat-footed it was caught on this question of the need for tests. It had all of this year to contemplate this. It had months where it should have been working with insurers so that if and when this happened, it could roll out smoothly. But that is not where we are.
Another piece of good news this week, Jason, is there's a CDC study saying that the booster dose, either of Pfizer or Moderna, seems to stop hospitalization 90% of the time. And Jason, that to me seems like a really good number, especially when you're talking about people who are over the age of 65, maybe, and are at higher risk of COVID in the first place.
Maybe it's good news. I'm going to give you a pessimistic read on the study, which is that we're seeing that Omicron, according to the journal's story, the vaccine is 90% effective against hospitalizations after at least 2 weeks after the booster dose. But after only two doses, only 57% effective against hospitalizations. I mean, this is an important study, to be clear, because it's a real world study of vaccinated people. It's not just, oh, you're vaccinated, let's measure your antibodies, or let's see. It's a real study of the actual outcomes. But 57% effectiveness is not great. And what it suggests to me is that boosters are going to be recommended continuously, because if you're only 57% effective with, you know, your two doses, presumably last year, what we've a consistent theme of these studies on the vaccines is that the antibodies wane. You know, they last, they're very protective, but they wane over time. I know there's debate over T cells and the rest of it, but to me it suggests that a booster is effective, good news. But what concerns me is that we may need repeated boosters, which is going to require people to get more shots, and I think, you know, participation may go down. So while it's great for people who are boosted, I do worry that the effectiveness was only 57% for those who are not boosted.
That's a fair point. I guess what I would say in response to that is the need for it may drop as COVID cases drop. And let's say, for the sake of argument, that Omicron is the last big wave, or there's one that's milder after that. After a while, you get to sort of a flu state where it's endemic, but it's not spreading rapidly throughout the population. So it reduces the risk of coming into contact with the virus to some extent. But to your point about after two doses being effective only 57%, I mean, that's an argument, I think, for a lot of people who are at risk of COVID to go and get the booster shot. And that's the choice that I made right before Christmas. I'll say that just because of looking at these numbers. But to Jason's point, Kim, I mean, it's true that there has been a drop off in participation. According to the CDC's latest numbers, population over the age of 65, 88% are fully vaccinated if you count that as two doses. But if you throw in the booster, it drops to only about 63% of people over age 65. And again, those are the people who are at most of risk from hospitalization in the first place.
Yeah, I think that this is a function of a couple of things, that drop off. And one is that there's been very differing guidance out there and opinions out there among doctors on booster use. You know, you've had some people say, go get your booster. You've had other very respected doctors who say boosters should be aimed at those over the age of 65 and those with underlying health conditions. Probably not necessary for those who are younger. That's an interesting, again, I don't know who's right. And that's one of the problems with COVID is that we have all kinds of very respected experts who have different views on this because it's an unprecedented disease. I think the other thing that has played into a lot of decisions to not get boosted is that we do know for a fact that, you know, those numbers you are talking about are booster effectiveness about 2 weeks after getting the booster. But there have been not just studies, but real world evidence that that booster doesn't remain effective for very, very long. In fact, there was one study saying that after about 10 weeks, the Pfizer booster was about 35% effective and the Moderna booster was about 45% effective. So that's why you've ended up having countries like Israel say, okay, well, fourth booster. But then in response to that, you've had a lot of professionals and experts begin to warn about constant booster use because at a certain point, it can wear out your immune system and actually make you more likely to catch an infectious disease because your immune system is tired out, as it were, or at least that's the theory. Again, I'm not a doctor. I'm repeating what different experts have said out there. But I think overall, this has got something to do with very varying guidance that keeps coming out from all directions, I think has become a bit confusing to people.
Well, and I take those points. I mean, just to provide a little bit of context, I mean, I got my booster in the middle of the Omicron wave, in part because of the Omicron wave. And it's true that I'm an annual flu shot guy anyway. I would rather have a little jab in the arm than to get sick with the flu for a week. And so I'm predisposed in the first place. But if the fourth booster comes along without the Omicron wave, it's possible people would make a different decision, Jason. So I don't know if this has changed your pessimism any at all.
Well, it depends where we want to end up or where we're going to end up. I mean, you said a flu-like state, which, you know, as I understand it, is about, you know, not more than 50,000 deaths per year or 1,000 a week averaged over the year. Obviously, it's seasonal, but we're still at a seven-day rolling average, from what I'm seeing, of over 2,000 deaths a day from COVID. So we're still not there with the flu-like situation. The question is what the practical question is, at what level do deaths and hospitalizations need to be in order for us to broadly get back to normal life? In my view, we're ready to do that. But I'm not sure that in some of our cities that that's going to be possible. I agree with you about the fourth booster. That would raise some questions. But we'll see where we end up. I mean, people have talked about an annual jab, which, you know, similar to the flu, which could be fine. But let's hope that, you know, we can get mortality down to similar to the flu as well.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Some interesting news from the political realm on a bit of jostling between two prominent figures. First of all, President Trump, and here he is talking last week on the OAN network.
Many politicians, I watched a couple of politicians be interviewed, and one of the questions was, did you get the booster? Because they had the vaccine. And they're answering it like, in other words, the answer is yes, but they don't want to say it. Because they're gutless. You got to say it. Whether you had it or not, say it.
And one of those politicians, at least it seemed to me, was Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida. And he answered the question again on Friday. Here he is.
That's something that, you know, I think people should just make their own decisions on. I'm not going to let that be a weapon for people to be able to use. I think it's a private matter. We've worked hard to be able to protect people so they don't lose their jobs on that. I have said publicly that, you know, the FDA recommended it against boosters for people in my age group, and the CDC overrode that. And I think that was based on politics. I don't think that that was based on science. Two of the top FDA people actually resigned in protest Many people didn't hear about that. You know why? Well, because it didn't fit the narrative. I can tell you, if you had a different president of a different party, that would have been hair on fire stuff.
Kim, what do you make of those two clips?
Well, on the Donald Trump side, the president, and this has been a very fascinating turn of events, has entirely embraced vaccination, which is good. It's a great thing to see him do and to have him send out that message to people. His argument is, look, we should be proud of the work that we did as an administration standing up these vaccines as quickly as we did and proud to go take them and be protected. And so it was notable that he used a gutless word, and he did it not long after. There's no question the politician who had been getting the most headlines about not saying whether or not he'd been boosted was DeSantis. So it seemed very much aimed at him. And then Mr. DeSantis, it should be noted on a podcast not long after that Trump comment, seemed to provide a little bit of a rebuke of Mr. Trump's COVID handling. He was asked about what one decision he would do differently. And DeSantis said that he had never thought that a national lockdown was on the radar. And if he'd have known how much federal health advisors like Dr. Anthony Fauci would panic, he would have protested over that notion of a national lockdown, quote, much louder, quote. So people have been taking this as a back and forth between the two politicians. I think it was a little overstated, especially if you listen to DeSantis's podcast. He seemed to be very much leveling his criticism at Fauci and other public health officials that were making, in his view, the very wrong call about lockdowns. I should also note that both camps, DeSantis and Trump, have strongly argued, or strongly stated that there's no issue between them, that they're not in fight having a, in fact, having a spat or a fight. It is notable, however, though, that Mr. DeSantis is a leading Republican and one of the few who has not declared that he will not run for president if Donald Trump is in the field. And so I don't think it would be surprising if there was a little tension there.
Well, we have the clip that Kim mentions, and it's DeSantis speaking on the Ruthless podcast. Listen to this.
I never thought in February, early March, that it would lead to locking down the country. I just didn't. I didn't think that was on the radar. I was dealing with, I mean, I had Pence and the CDC director down at Port Everglades talking about cruise ships the second week of March, and no one was talking about shutting down the country. And I think if knowing now what I know then, if that was a threat earlier, I would have been much louder about, you know, trying to say this is not.
So I take Kim's point that there are other arguments going on here other than the one between the allegedly between DeSantis and Trump, and they have both said things that they're not in any sort of spat. What I find a little bit perplexing is a word DeSantis used, which is why should it be used as a weapon against me? And why would he think that way? I mean, either he did get booted or he didn't get boosted, and people can make their own decisions. He's argued that as the governor of Florida, and people make their own risk calls. President Trump has proclaimed that he did get boosted, but then again, President Trump is 75 years old. Ron DeSantis is not 75 years old. I think he's 43 years old. So they're making different calculations there. And I just am a little bit confused about why this has become such a hot potato.
Well, first of all, Kyle, you disclosed your booster status earlier in this podcast. That was courageous. Personally, I don't want it to be used as a weapon against me. So I will not disclose. No, I'm just kidding. But it is interesting that he said the word weapon. I think what he meant by it was, well, some people might interpret it that he meant he is boosted, but he doesn't want to tell anyone because Republican primary voters may oppose the booster or be anti-vaxxers, and they would count that against Governor DeSantis. I mean, that seemed to be one of the dominant interpretations of what he's been saying. It seems to me the opposite. He said he is not boosted, it sounds like to me, and he doesn't want that used as a, quote, weapon against him by the press and his Democratic opponents. But it's sort of a Rorschach test of how you see him using that word.
Can I actually jump in here, though? I actually have a slightly different interpretation about why he wouldn't say that. And that is that, you know, just as for a long time, there was a certain shame factor that Democrats were wielding. If you weren't vaccinated, you were a deplorable. That has now grown into a similar version in terms of boosters, even though, as you mentioned, Kyle, there's a lot of varying guidance on this. DeSantis mentioned that as well, too. And even though it's a harder call than basic vaccinations. But the other thing, and I think this is important, DeSantis has for months now been waging a campaign to make sure that employees, workers, et cetera, cannot be discriminated against if they weren't vaccinated. And as we see growing calls out there, especially among Democrats, that the two-shot vaccine regime should now be turned into a boosted regime as well, and that only if you do all of the shots are you considered fully vaccinated, I think he's guarding against that.
Well, there will certainly be more Rorschach tests on this, I'm sure, to come. But one last thing here is we have a reader email from Dan in Minneapolis. And we were talking earlier about the Democrats' push to have a carve-out in the filibuster. And he writes this: one question I'm wondering about with the filibuster being in the news, what other tools, mechanisms, procedures, etc., besides the filibuster, can the Senate minority use to grind legislation to a halt? All the attention is on the ramifications of nuking the filibuster, but it seems overblown that the Senate would suddenly turn into a majoritarian body on the House. Perhaps you could shed some light on how Senate Republicans would respond in a future podcast, unquote. And Kim, we'll just throw that to you. It seems to me there are a lot of tools, and part of it just depends on how bloody-minded the minority party wants to be.
Yeah, so here's the important thing to know about the Senate. It's an unusual body, or I should say it's a glorious body in this regard, in that it is designed entirely around enhancing the rights of individual senators at the expense of the majority. So to the extent the Senate even functions at all, it's only because individual senators willingly relinquish those prerogatives that they have. The biggest one is called unanimous consent. And that's a world in which basically a senator asks all 99 colleagues to give up their right to object to a proposal. And right now, Senate leaders entirely rely on unanimous consent dozens of times a day to get anything done. I mean, you need unanimous consent to open up the Senate before noon. You need unanimous consent to dispense with the reading of the preceding day's journal, which, by the way, can take hours. You need UC to move business and to avoid reading out loud the text of every single amendment and resolution and to get out of roll call votes. If you had just one Republican who decided that they were no longer going to go along with unanimous consent, you could make every day in the Senate a crawl where just getting on legislation could take days and days and days. Getting off it could take weeks. You could evacuate. There's other things. People can leave the floor. You can have the sergeant of arms have to round them up. You can have quorum calls. This is like the idea of Schumer just saying, well, we're going to break the Senate rules. It doesn't necessarily mean they'd get anything done.
And if you doubt that either party would go that far, I mean, imagine Republicans trying to pass a national right-to-work law, or Democrats trying to pass a bill to overrule state right-to-work laws, or Democrats trying to pass a bill to codify Roe v. Wade, or Republicans doing the reverse. Jason, I mean, I think there are all sorts of opportunities you can imagine where one party would be trying to pass something and the other party would be fully willing, and its voters, its supporters would be fully willing to go to the mat to block it.
Yeah, the United States Senate, as Kim says, it's a fascinating body. And to our reader's point, I mean, it has always been different from the House. There, as Joe Manchin said in explaining his opposition to breaking the filibuster, there has never been a rule in the Senate where you can end debate with a simple majority. There's things in the Senate, you know, for nominations where a single senator can hold up a president's nomination through a committee. There's just much more autonomy still in these rules that have been implemented and maintained and reformed over two centuries that make it a different kind of body where one senator, as Kim says, still has some power. You don't need a majority. And it may be that we're moving towards a purely majoritarian Senate. I mean, some Senate majority will just completely nuke everything, you know, eliminate, unravel the foundations of the Senate. I mean, I'm a conservative, so I think, you know, rules that have developed, we have to think about why they've developed. And the Senate was designed to be different from the House of Representatives. It was designed that the rules would force a different kind of debate and deliberation than exists in the House. And let's hope that that distinctiveness can be maintained in some way.
Thank you, Jason and Kim. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcast app. We'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.